Okay, it seems to be recording. All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our journal club. It's about the articles from February, and Julian was so kind to look at two of the journals. And I think Julian, do you want to take it away,
Yes, I'm
please?
going to share my screen. Okay, so I'm going to discuss two papers, as Dr. Lauren said, and I'm going to start with one about node carcinoma. And this manuscript was entitled Misleading Germ Cell Phenotype in Pulmonary Node Carcinoma Harboring the ZNFF532 node M1 fusion. And was published by the group of Christopher French in the Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston. So they start saying that you know, node carcinomas are historically considered malignancies of children and young adults, and that they can occur in anybody's site, although some they were historically known to be midline malignancy, but it's well known that they can occur in other areas in the body. So that, and they also said that in their background, by after reading the literature, that the only morphologic hint for diagnosis is abrupt squamous differentiation that occurs in up to 40% of the cases. And the classic fusion is a BRD4 not M1 that occurs in 70% of the cases, but there are other non-common fusion partners, including a group of zinc finger proteins like ZNF532, like in this case, or ZNF592. And they specifically mentioned that this only occurs in, has only been reported in three cases. And this family of protein, this Z4 zinc a protein complex colocalize and interact with this oncogenic complex, the BRD4 not that it's the most commonly reported. So they, it's basically, I know we usually don't describe case reports. This is kind of a case report with a review of literature, and they also explain some other cases. So I thought it was interesting because of the other cases that is 10 as well. So they, this is a, there was a case of a 77.5 centimeter mass in the left lower lung, or a six in a 65-year-old woman who had a smoking history. And the case was misdiagnosed before the diagnosis was established. And they ended up doing a lot of immunos and also did RNA-seq and FISH. And after establishing the diagnosis, they also screened other seven node carcinomas from head and neck and lung that had the BRD4 node M1 fusion or the NSD3 node M1 fusion. So they describe the case that it is interesting because it has a undifferentiated monoadenous small cell round cell morphology, which has also some focal epithelial and rival elements, and also a few plasmacytoid-looking cells. There's I will show you the pictures. There's also some myxoid stroma, and it seems to be ending on the bronchial growth. And there was no keratinization. And actually, by immunohistochemistry, there was only focal pankeratin, mancerokeratin expression, but there was extensive CD30 and also PLAB immunostain expression of this protein. So in this, it seemed that the case was in 5-4 pathology groups, and it was initially diagnosed as a combined small cell carcinoma because it had a CD56 positivity, but also because it had CD30 positivity, was also classified as an unclassifiable hematolymphoid malignancy. And then ended up being classified as malignant cell germ cell neoplasm because it had PLAB positivity. So as you can see, it was kind of a mess, you know, like four different diagnoses, very different from each other. And after they sent the case, it seems that they sent the case to the Brigham, and they found diffuse expression of NOD. And then with FISH, this confirmed the diagnosis. And they did RNA sequencing, which revealed this ZNF532 not M1 fusion. Then they screened seven cases of NOD carcinomas, and most of them were with the classic BRD4 NOD1 fusion, and two other with the NSD3 and NOD fusion. And they screened them for germ cell markers, and they found some focal cell for reactivity in three cases, and variable AFP expression in two. But none of the tumors express CD30 or PLAB, like in the case that they described, or nor beta HCG, OCT4, or CD117. So they also reviewed the literature and found, four cases of NOD carcinomas that had these zinc proteins. And they found that actually they had a similar morphology on differentiated epithelial round cell morphology with some ribbon component, and they were keratin poor and without squamous differentiation. Two other cases had the same fusion partner and were found in the lung as well. And they had they also mentioned that there are several reports that have elevation of AFP, and they reviewed these cases as well. I think this was just a literature review, and they found that none of these cases had expression of germ cell markers, which included PLAB, AFP, CD30, HCG, SALT4, OCT4, and CD117. So I think I'm just gonna show you the pictures. Can you see the figures here?
Yeah.
So this is a tumor, has an endobronchial distribution and had definitely this kind of epidermoid nested cells, and that they say that in some areas mimic it, a salivary gland tumor. But there are also areas with a lot of mixed stroma and this round blue cells. And in some areas have this spindle cell cordon morphology. But there also were solid areas, epithelial morphology and spindle cell morphology. And as you can see here, there is black staining here, which is kind of a strong. And also CD30 positivity here. Not one, sorry, and CD30 positivity here. So I think it's just, this is an aberrant immunophenotype. It's very rare, but I think it's they just wanted to show this case and the other cases that stain, because it can infrequently be present in NOD carcinomas, and this can lead to misdiagnosis, like in this case. Of course, this is a very small study, and they didn't review the other cases that had the zinc protein, even though some of those cases were reported by Dr. French. So they probably didn't have material to stain for the germ cell tumors. Okay, so that's that manuscript, and now I'm gonna discuss the other one.
Just a second. Thank you so much. Does anyone have a question to the paper? So I was wondering, did they actually go into the possibility that NOD can stain germ cell tumors? Because NOD stands for nuclear protein of testis. And in the IHC lab, we use testis as a positive control because the spermatocytes are positive. And I know in the spermatocytic tumors, NOD can be expressed. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it actually can be expressed in seminomas, since we never really stain it. Yeah. But would that come into the differential diagnosis?
That's a good point, because it's not in the discussion. And actually, they are sure these cases are not, because they have the sequencing results and they have the fusion event, but they actually didn't mention that, and I think that's a really important consideration, because maybe some of the cases that are reported in literature may not be necessarily not carcinomas. I think all the ones that they report, those other zinc protein mutated ones. They have fish from those. I mean, in the report, in the papers. But I'm sure the opposite can be true as well, that some years some tumors can express not. I guess, you know, the point of this paper is that probably you have to do molecular in all the cases to make sure, you know, that you have a not carcinoma and not something else, or the opposite.
Well, that's another good question. Sorry, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that we say you have to do sequencing, but that makes the assumption that what they discovered is a disease-defining aberration, and that may or may not be true, I think is your point, Anya. And so I think it's a great question. And in terms of learning from this case, while acknowledging that what we're learning is ambiguous, it would be really useful for me to hear how others use NUT. Like, when do you use it? So they say this was a wrong diagnosis, assuming their interpretation is correct, and that it would have been rescued had someone done that stain. When do you do it? How often do you do it?
Well, I do it if I do see a small round blue cell tumor, specifically if it looks monotonous, usually with some more prominent nucleoli. But even if I think about a small cell carcinoma, but it doesn't really fit all the stains or all the morphology doesn't really fit very well, then I usually do it too. What do other people do?
Undifferentiated looking carcinomas, NUT and BRG1 is kind of, you know, after everything is ruled out before signing out, NUT, BRG1, and as the two final stains.
PIT2 is kind of a set, you know, INI1, BRG1, and NUT. So, you know, the continuation of that, you know, Anya's question, you know, I exactly was thinking the same thing. You know, maybe it's a little ignorant one. You know, how do we know the NUT translocation is specific or not? You know, so in other words, because of the nature of the gene, you know, is a germ cell ever tested for that translocation and or, you know, expression of NUT protein?
It's a matter of definition, right? And based on the WHO, it's defined as an entity, but may not be an entity then if we start sequencing other things, right?
I have no idea, but, you know.
I mean, they have a clinical, I mean, very specific clinical picture, right? They're very, very malignant, right? And the progression is super fast.
That's right. You know, clinically different than, you know, the only thing is it's not seminoma, that's for sure. You know, it looks different. So I guess, yeah, you're right.
Given those previous diagnoses, had the patient been treated as if she had a germ cell tumor? And if so, what happened?
They didn't actually mention anything about treatment, which is interesting. You know, the clinical picture, it's kind of, I mean, they give a CT scan and just say the location of the tumor and the age, nothing else, sadly. So, yeah, it's just... Actually, they have here, I'm sorry. Yes. So, the patient had multiple metastases detected by imaging in the liver, peritoneum, and inguinal iliac, priority, mesenteric lymph nodes. Under palliative treatment, the patient died of progressive disease 34 months from the initial diagnosis. I mean, it could be consistent with not.
Could be consistent with anything.
Well, yeah, right. But 34 months is kind of fast. Well, I don't know.
But it doesn't look like that the patient got a germ cell specific treatment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Then
may I add one comment? This is Yingqing. So we did an IHC study on like 54 NUT carcinoma. I look at the data this morning. There's 12 cases got stained with cell 4, and only 2 cases have like focal weak staining. So I think cell 4 can be useful in this particular situation because you never diffuse and strong positive in NUT, at least in our 12 cases.
Thanks, Yingjun.
Okay. Okay, but discuss the other one. So I think the other one is interesting because it is a clinical paper, but I chose it because it shows, you know, part of the how the pulmonary critical care medicine field is looking at interstitial pneumonias, and this may impact of, you know, on what we get or on or also when the patients get biopsies or so. So this was a prospective nationwide multicenter cohort study done in Japan to determine the clinical significance of autoimmune features in idiopathic interstitial pneumonias. It's pulsing thorax, and they mentioned, you know, that the 20 to 30% of patients with idiopathic interstitial pneumonias showed autoimmune features. And because of this, you know, the ERS and the ATS met, and they published in 2015 in the European Respiratory Journal proposed research criteria for interstitial pneumonia with autoimmune features, IPAF. And, you know, they say, you know, also that retrospective studies reported that there were conflicting results about the prognosis of this new criteria. And they wanted to study this in a prospective fashion, in a large cohort and in a multicenter nationwide cohort. So they actually enrolled consecutive patients with idiopathic interstitial pneumonias in 28 hospitals in Japan. And their primary endpoint was to evaluate overall survival of patients with IPAF. And all the IPF and idiopathic interstitial pneumonia diagnoses were made in accordance to the 2011 official ATS ERS, you know, the criteria statement of the IPF. And also in the 2013 official update of the ATS ERS in the classification of idiopathic interstitial pneumonias. And the diagnoses were done by MDD, by expert pulmonologists, and also on-site radiologists and pathologists with more than 10 years of experience. And in addition to the diagnosis, the radiologists and pathologists also collected some data. And besides this, you know, the patients that had a defined diagnosis of systemic autoimmune disease were excluded. And they used different criteria for all of the diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. And they also studied the relation between these autoimmune features with other prognostic characteristics in a prospective fashion. So they had they used a checklist when they enrolled the patients with to evaluate 63 features suggestive of connective tissue disease. So it was a very extensive checklist. And they classify the patients in three categories, acute, subacute, and chronic in idiopathic pneumonias. And they have different, you know, less than 1 month, 1 to 3 months, or more than 3 months after the onset of respiratory symptoms. And after this, you know, when they had all the data, they actually did a clustering analysis to classify the patients in different clinical phenotypes. So they had a large cohort of 376 patients. Most patients had IPF, 31%. There were few with NSIP of cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. But what I found very interesting, they say that, you know, they had unclassified idiopathic interstitial pneumonia with surgical biopsy, but most patients, actually 50% of patients, were unclassifiable because they didn't have a surgical biopsy. So then, most patients had a chronic onset and they had relatively preserved FVC, but also most of them had, of course, the impaired DLCO. So they didn't find any significant difference in the frequencies of histologic findings suggestive of connective tissue disease. And what they mentioned, which features are these, are lymphoid aggregates with germinal centers, prominent plasmacytic infiltration, or dense perivascular colon and extensive pleuritis. They say that the patient without IPF had a higher frequency of anti-synthetase antibodies in comparison with IPF. But almost 20% of patients met the IPAF criteria defined by ATS and ERS. And the patient meeting this criteria was were higher. The frequency of patient meeting this criteria was higher in NSIP and CUP compared to IPS or unclassifiable pneumonia. They also say that the patients that had met the IPAF criteria were younger, predominantly women, and more likely to be never smokers and have NSIP or COP. But it were the patients with IPAF were rare in the IPF group. So also something really interesting is that patients that met the criteria frequently develop systemic autoimmune disease after 35 months of follow-up. And it was less, this patient had less frequent acute exacerbations also compared to patients that didn't meet the IPAF criteria. But the most important thing is that the IPAF diagnosis was significantly associated with better survival and was an independent positive prognostic factors in patients without IPF, but not in IPF. So it means that they also did adjustments. They did a Cox proportional hazard model and also multivariable analysis and show that, you know, IPAF is relevant for non-IPF IPF pneumonias, but in IPF, it didn't seem to matter. So they did a cluster analysis and they found these four clusters. The cluster one is basically a cluster of pure IPF with UIP pattern on CT. The cluster three are female patients without IPF and with the autoimmune features, with the IPAF, meeting the IPAF criteria. Cluster two, it's a bit less defined, but it basically are male patients with chronic onset and preserved lung function. And they were basically diagnosed by medical checkup, but didn't have any symptoms. And cluster four, it's a cluster of patients without IPF and with symptoms. So they found that the cluster two and three, basically cluster with women with IPAF, meeting the IPAF criteria, and the cluster of patients that were diagnosed with by medical checkups but without symptoms had a significantly better prognosis than those in cluster one and four. And those are the patients with IPF and patients without IPF but that don't have IPAF. So in conclusion, you know, like IPAF was less frequently patients with IPAF had less acute exacerbation and also developed a systemic autoimmune disease more often than patients without the IPAF criteria. And also the meeting the IPAF criteria makes the patient, it actually was associated with sort of better survival in patients without IPF. You know, there are a bunch of limitations, I have to say, although it's a good study because it's a multi-center study and also nationwide study. But they said, you know, the numbers of patients that met the IPAF criteria in the IPF group was very small for prognostic evaluation, only 6 cases. And this may be the reason why, you know, IPAF doesn't seem to matter in IPF. It may just be a statistical issue. And also, there was no central review of CT scans or lung biopsies. It was done in each site. So, you know, the diagnosis may be not that uniform, even though, you know, they're using the criteria that we know well. And there was not a good phenotypic description of the clusters. I'm sure they have the data, but they didn't put it in the paper. Yeah, I think that's all what I have. And here are the, you know, the Kaplan-Meier curves. And you can see, you know, that different survival with IPAF and non-IPAF in all patients and in non-IPF, but not in IPF. And I think it's interesting that, you know, they develop systemic autoimmune diseases with over time. And also that they have definitely a lower incidence of acute exacerbation compared with the patient that didn't meet the criteria.
Thank you, Julian. Appreciate that. Nice review. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. You know, if I remember correctly, in IPAF criteria, NSIP and organizing pneumonia are included, you know, in addition to what you described, you know, the lymphoid hyperplasia, plasma cells and all that. So it's kind of a little screwy to say IPEF because the NSIP and OP are kind of part of IPEF, you know, features at least, you know. So, and the, another question is, you cannot compare the survival between IPEF and, you know, with and without, when you have already a lot more organized pneumonia and NSIP in that with IPEF group than IPF, because, you know, they are already better regardless with IPEF. So you may have said it, but my question is then, did they look at OP and NSIP group with and without, you know, additional IPEF features in survival? And you already said in IPF, it didn't seem to have any difference in the survival, but in non-IPF group, with and without IPEF, there was difference or no difference? You kind of showed that graph quickly, and I wasn't quite sure it was there or not.
Oh, no, they actually didn't look in the difference in between each groups. And I'm actually looking at the criteria here. I have the paper from in the European Respiratory Journal. And yes, even though, you know, the morphologic domain may include, you know, radiology or histopathology, suggestive NSIP, OP, or LIP, or the overlap, it seems that you have to meet at least one of the criteria from these two domains. So you can't have patients that don't have OP or NSIP or LIP. And, you know, I think other thing is that most of the patients didn't have biopsies. So I think they're mostly based in their definition on the clinical domains than in the morphological domain. But
yeah, according to their methods, their checklist was signs, symptoms, and laboratory results. So they identified patients based on an incomplete set of criteria for recognition, number one. Number two, I agree with the comments about the way these are conflated with the histology. Those lines, the differences in survival, would be exactly what you'd see if you compared a population in which NSIP and organizing pneumonia were overrepresented to patients in whom UIP was overrepresented, whether diagnosed by HRCT or biopsy. And the most telling observation, it seems to me, is that when they looked at patients with IPF, which I think is a surrogate here for UIP, because I'm not sure what IPF that's IPAF means, but when you look there, the histology didn't matter at all in outcome, which has really been where the discussion is around IPAF, that when you see histology that makes you think about connective tissue disease, does it matter in a biopsy with UIP? And this study would suggest no, but this study's all over the map in terms of the populations they're studying. It isn't clear to me that it's really the group that was identified in the original IPAF paper, because the morphologic domain is not addressed.
You also have to wonder.
I'm wondering if, you know, like they just, it is a prospective cohort, but just on regular clinical grounds, how, because many patients don't get biopsy, right? So it is, I mean, probably making a better study will have been very costly, and they didn't, or, you know, unfeasible maybe, and that's why they didn't do it in another way. But of course, it makes a point in which it may make the study very limited, because we don't have histopathology in other cases.
Well, you don't have to have it. The morphologic domain includes HRCT. But at least according to what they say in the, and maybe of their 63 items on their checklist, HRCT was there, but that's not what they say. They say signs, symptoms, and laboratory results.
Well, they say that actually, I think actually I have the paper here, and they say that most criteria were in the checklist, except three, if I am not wrong. I think I remember reading that. So yeah, there were only three criteria that were not actually pressing the checklist. That's what they say. But actually, I don't remember which one.
Anyway. Henry, you had a comment?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said about the problems with the paper. You kind of have to wonder why this showed up in BMJ rather than a pulmonary medicine journal. And I suspect that a lot of the reviewers had similar issues and it got rejected from other journals.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for the comments. Very interesting discussion. Maybe we should move on in the interest of time. Julian, can you stop sharing, please? And then I can share my screen. All right. I hope you see the PDF now of the next paper. And so this paper is from Zhu and colleagues, entitled Assessment of the Feasibility of Frozen Sections for the Detection of Spread Through Air Spaces in Pulmonary Adenocarcinoma. This is a collaboration between NYU and MGH, and it was published in Modern Pathology. The purpose was to evaluate the reliability of STAS assessment on frozen section. And I have to say, I'm glad that people don't ask that at the current time for us, and then to assess associations among STAS, tumor grade, and recurrence-free survival after sublobar resection. That was a retrospective study. They included stage 1 adenocarcinomas who underwent frozen section lab. And then at the frozen section, they had one section of tumor with adjacent benign lung. And then after the frozen section, whatever tissue remained from this one section was then permanentized and called the frozen section control. And then the remainder of the tissue was inflated with formalin, fixed for 6 hours, and the entire tumor was submitted for permanent. STAS was defined by the 2015 WHO criteria. So basically, tumor clusters, solid nests, or single cancer cells beyond the edge of the main tumor. The tumor grade was identified according to the recommendations by the IASLC, which is grade 1, well-differentiated, lipidic predominant, less than 20% of high-grade pattern, and the high-grade patterns are the solid micropapillae and complex glands. Grade 2, moderately differentiated, is acinar or papillae predominant with less than 20% high-grade pattern. And grade 3 is poorly differentiated with any tumor with at least 20% high-grade pattern. They included 163 patients. 94 of those underwent sublobar resections. STAS prevalence was 28% at frozen section, 19% at the frozen section control section, and 24% in the permanent tumor. So STAS on frozen section compared to permanent had a sensitivity of only 55%. The agreement had a kappa of 0.34, and the specificity was 80%. So in total, they had 24 fast positive STAS on frozen section. And then if they included the frozen section control, so this was the slide that was permanentized from the slide that was used for the frozen section, then the sensitivity actually decreased to 52%. And they thought that was mostly due to increased FAS STAS on the frozen section control due to artifacts. If they compared tumor grade at frozen section versus the permanent section, the agreement was higher with a kappa of 0.54. And if they combined the tumor grade 1 and 2 and compared it versus 3 between frozen section versus permanent, then the agreement actually went up to a kappa of 0.72. The STAS was associated with higher tumor grade. And then basically the findings were the same for sublobar resections and the entire cohort. STAS was associated with recurrence-free survival, but only on the permanent, not on the frozen section STAS. And then the grade was also associated with recurrence-free survival on both the frozen section and the permanent. So basically, diffraction section stairs had a low sensitivity and positive predictive value. There were a lot of false positive results, which could have resulted in an overtreatment. So if they would have started with a sublobar resection and then they would have said there is stairs, then the surgeon may have gone to a lobectomy. So they concluded that intraoperative stairs is currently likely not a safe indicator for more extensive surgery, and I completely agree with that. They thought that tumor grading may be a better predictor of tumor recurrence than stairs at the time of surgery. For me, it wasn't really clear who actually evaluated these cases, whether it was the thoracic pathologist or a general pathologist, whether one or multiple pathologists looked at that. There was no mention of any inter-observer variability, which I think is probably pretty high. And then stairs is a covariate of high-grade morphology. I think that's what we see all along. There was no multivariate analysis performed to really prove that.
Hi, Dr. I can comment in a couple of things because I was in this paper. So there's a prior paper that we published about the inter-observer variability with the MGH cohort only. That data wasn't available for the NYU cohort. And of course, it's all over the mess. You know, it's all over, it's a mess. What I think in this paper, I mean, there were two cohorts that we put together, and in both cohorts there was a consensus diagnosis in each case. So in the MGH cohort, there were two thoracic pathologists and myself. We met and revealed the cases at the same time, and we're recording the different characteristics. And in the NYU cohort, there were two thoracic pathologists. So. That's
okay, very good.
Thanks.
Any questions? So I had a question. What do you guys do? Do you inflate actually all your lung tumor specimens and before you cut them for permanent? You know, what I would be worried about, but maybe it's wrong, that you actually falsely induce stairs with that.
Yeah, that's an important question. And yes, we inflate the cases. Unfortunately, that's something when a study wanted to do a study where inflation and with inflation, but it wasn't our clinical protocols. But yeah, because that's a definitely important characteristic that has been, you know, mentioned by, I think, Dr. Tonensen, right? A theory of artifactual stairs. But most places actually inflate the lung. So I am sure there may be some artifacts that can be classified as stairs because of that, but we couldn't prove it with these studies.
So what do other people do?
This is Jeff. We do not routinely inflate those specimens.
Okay.
Nor are we asked about stairs at the time of frozen section.
Which I think is clearly good, right?
Yeah. I think the truth is the decision still today for less than lobectomy is largely driven by the patient's physiology and status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other question I had, do other people have problems with distinguishing artificial stairs and real stairs? I mean, there are these criteria, but I'm not sure if I can tell all the time.
I'll freely confess I've never given it a second thought.
Okay, that makes me feel better, thank you.
Well, I mean, only because, you know, as pathologists, we get more and more tunnel vision and we talk about these things like they're critically important. But I've polled oncologists and surgeons and they don't think it's important at all. So, I mean, you know, at some point you have to focus on the things that matter most and not spend so much emotional and intellectual energy on the things that matter least. And I can't think of anything that matters less than stairs.
All right, very good. Okay, if there are no other questions, the last paper I wanted to present is This from Kalshim Deckel and colleagues from MSK, entitled Shape Sensing Robotic Assisted Bronchoscopy in the Diagnosis of Pulmonary Parenchymal Lesions, that was published in CHEST. And, you know, it's not a pathology paper, but it's a paper about a what to me was a new technique in the bronchoscopy suite. And I thought that should give us all specimens that are now sufficient for diagnosis. Well, we'll see. So they talked about, this is actually just for the method here. So their purpose was to identify feasibility, diagnostic yield, diagnostic sampling, and safety of this new technique. And in the past, the diagnostic yield of guided bronchoscopy, so these navigational guided bronchoscopies, was 44 to 74%, in contrast to percutaneous biopsies, which have a diagnostic yield of over 90%. And so this sketch here is from a different paper because they didn't really went into their method. But so here is the new instrument, that's the bronchoscope with the arm. And you can see already here on the monitor, you actually have various monitoring. You have the fluoroscopy, you have the, just a bronchoscopy in situ, and then you have the EBAS. And then you have a three-dimensional image. And so if you go to the three-dimensional image, which this can do, you have your airway here, and there's the bronchoscope. So you see exactly where you are in the bronchoscope. And then this is the target lesion. You see your angle of the bronchoscope. Here is the fluorescence. And then here you can appreciate where you are with your bronchoscope in regards to the lesion. And it actually tells you how far you are from the lesion. And so in this picture, this shows you that you are actually in the lesion. So basically the bronchoscopist should have a good idea where you are. And what they usually do is they have a pre-procedural CT, which identifies the target location and also creates a kind of a roadmap how you get best with your robotic catheter to that lesion. And this is an FDA-approved method since 2019. And I actually ask our people, they actually do have that. And what they do is during the procedure, when they think they are in the lesion, they do a quick CT scan to confirm that they are in the lesion. And since this is robotic, they can be far away from the CT. So the bronchoscopist can be far away from the CT scan, and so it doesn't get all the radiation. So now back to the MSK study, they included 131 consecutive of these procedures. They had a successful, or they defined a successful navigation as achieving catheter target proximity that allowed lesion sampling. They did ROS evaluation of all the cytology material. And in total, they sampled 159 pulmonary lesions during these 131 procedures. You actually can sample multiple lesions during these procedures. Their median lesion size was 1.8 centimeter, but ranged between 1.3 and 2.7 centimeters. In 67%, they were beyond the sixth generation airway. In 39%, they were at the outer location. So that's the outer one third. Their navigational success rate was 99%. Their overall diagnostic yield was 82%. And based on the multivariate analysis, a lesion size of 1.8 centimeter or higher was more likely to be of diagnostic material than smaller lesion sites. Their overall complication rate was comparable with all the other procedures, was only 3%. So it's a good safety, possibly useful in challenging lung lesions. Again, the lesion size seems to matter, but according to our people, they really love the technique and they think they get a much higher diagnostic yield. They can't use it right now for cryobiopsies. They still have some issues with the cryobiopsies and the yield. I mean, sometimes we see beautiful cryobiopsies, but nothing in them. So if they could use it for cryobiopsies, it might be even better. I don't know if other people have experience with that. As I said, I didn't even know we use that, but hopefully we see better biopsies.
So Anya, do they actually do the procedures in the CT scan suite? Because you can't just move a patient, I think, from the Bronx suite to the CT scan.
I was afraid you would ask that.
Okay.
I haven't asked that yet.
Okay.
I kind of would think so.
Yeah.
But all the discussion took place over the weekend. So I didn't want to ask them that too. But it occurred to me too. So I have to find that out.
Anya, this is really interesting. So far as I know, this technology is not in use here. But my question is, without a direct comparison, it's hard for me to tell how much better this is, right? I mean, yep. 70% for lesions bigger than a centimeter, although it sounds like all of them were. It says 66% for lesions less than a centimeter. But as I understand it, the range was 1.3 to 2.7. So yep. I didn't understand there were any that small. And I look at that number and I'm a little disappointed, thinking, well, if they confirm they were there on 99%, what is it then that was the barrier to getting a diagnosis?
That is a good question. They did, to my knowledge, they did not really answer that. And so I don't know, I have to say. Whether it was they didn't get the answers they were looking for, you know, if the pathologist may have had a benign answer, but they were looking, they and the CT scan indicated that it should be malignant. That might be a disconcordance, and they may have said this is not successful. I don't know. But that's a good question. All right. Well, thanks for your participation. There are a few other notation items, a few review items, and then a letter from Pelosi regarding a previous report on lung neuroendocrine neoplasms. And it seems like in this letter, we more and more think now also about neuroendocrine tumors, going from neuroendocrine neoplasms, going from neuroendocrine tumors developing into high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas, while previously we really separate them and thought that they are different genomic-wise and so on. But there seem to be some studies underway in that regard too. Thank you very much and enjoy your Monday.
Great journal club. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.